from the Radio Ranch in beautiful Sugar Land, Texas, where life truly is sweeter. It's the Bombastic Blogcast for Monday, January 8th, 2024. I am the G-Man, Dan Gallo.
Hey, G-Man.
Hey there yourself. Defender of the peace, keeper of the justice, purveyor of truth, and one heck of a nice guy. And since it is Monday, let's do the Monday march back to work. Come on, everybody. Stiffen your backbone, put a smile on your face, take a deep breath, and keep a prayer on your lips. That certainly couldn't hurt. Let's get things started officially with
the Daily Datagram.
You got it. Words of wisdom, words of inspiration, brain droppings, or noggin nuggets. You get to make the call. It says here, it's far better to be alone than to wish you were. Been there, done that. Wear the t-shirt every day. However, really good company is hard to beat.
I claim this planet in the name of Mars.
Let's move along now to the so-called educational part of the blogcast. Here we go.
Twisted history.
I love it.
Gather around, kids, because a lot of things happen on this day throughout history.
Oh, yeah.
Some cool, some not so cool. Just the same. You need to know your twisted history.
Yes, you do.
You might be quizzed.
Yeah, see, there you go. Well, kids, it was on this day in 1940, as Britain entered World War II, the government introduced food rationing. Finally, the British people got some real relief. God, British food. Brr. And it was on this day in 1964, President Johnson declared a war on poverty in the United States. I'm sure you noticed it didn't work. We lost. And now you have to reach up to hit bottom these days.
Good luck with your layoffs, all right? I hope your firings go really well.
Everything regarding our government these days and our government officials and our politicians is contentious. It's nothing but contention, contention, contention. And I'm afraid the only thing that's going to get everybody to fire on all eight cylinders in the same direction these days would be a third world war. We're not far from that. But in a recent development that has sparked considerable debate among House Republicans, a trip to the southern border highlighted the ongoing crisis and the differing opinions on how to address it. You would think that this was something that clear-minded conservatives would be able to agree on. Now, the visit was aimed at witnessing the challenges posed by illegal immigration firsthand. And it brought to light the urgency for policy changes to secure the nation's borders. Now, during a press conference, a heated exchange occurred when a group of lawmakers was asked whether they would support a government shutdown as leverage to compel the Biden administration to close the border. Now, Representative Pat Fallon, a Republican out of Texas, just vehemently objected to the request for a show of hands, stating, "We're not going to do a show of hands. We're not in a classroom. We're not doing a show of hands." This response has since been met with criticism from some quarters who view it as dismissive of the gravity of the situation. And as I watch the continuing numbers of people coming across our southern border, I can't help but get the idea that the people in Washington, even the ones that we conservatives have voted for, are not getting a firm grasp of what's happening here. So now the incident underscores the tension within the party on how to confront what a lot of conservatives see as an open border policy under the current administration. And while some advocate for more drastic measures, such as a government shutdown, others seem hesitant to commit to that kind of an approach, focusing instead on individual appropriations bills. So Speaker Johnson indicated that the House will push forward with passing these bills, having already managed to prevent a Christmas omnibus bill from the Senate, with deadlines looming to fund parts of the federal government, and the pressures mounting to find a solution that addresses border security concerns. Now, the trip to Texas by little over 60 House Republicans was intended to shed light on the impact of what they describe as Biden's border crisis. Now, the lawmakers have emphasized the need for significant policy changes, and they continue to push for solutions that would effectively secure the border. And the refusal to participate in a symbolic gesture of commitment to border closure has led to further discussions on the resolve of certain members of Congress. Critics are arguing that if representatives aren't willing to take a public stand on this critical issue, it calls into question their dedication to resolving the crisis. Now, the conversation has extended beyond the press conference, with discussions taking place on various platforms about the perceived arrogance of some lawmakers, and Lord knows the arrogance is there, plus their approach to the border issue. The country's ongoing crisis needs decisive action. And the public's watching closely now to see which elected officials are prepared to take a firm stance. We are in an election year. And I think your rank and file voter is paying a little more attention these days to what is and isn't taking place. Now, as the debate continues, and Lord knows it will, it's pretty clear that the border crisis remains contentious and polarizing. And the Republican Party faces the challenge of uniting behind a strategy that not only resonates with the conservative base, but also effectively addresses the complexities of immigration and border security. We got plenty of immigration, but no border security. A new set of documents related to the Jeffrey Epstein case has been unveiled, revealing a connection to Hillary Clinton. And this latest disclosure kind of adds a significant twist to the ongoing investigation into the disgraced financier's activities. I mean, this thing actually is on the threshold of busting wide open. We're going to find some really interesting stuff. I think we're going to find out, too, that, and this is just speculation on my part, but I think we're going to find out that Epstein did not kill himself. But anyhow, to the subject at hand, the documents, which surfaced on Friday afternoon, are part of a 2015 defamation lawsuit involving Virginia Jeffrey, I think that's how you pronounce her name, who is the probably best-known victim of Epstein's sex trafficking ring, and Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's associate. Now, within these pages, it's been discovered that computers were removed from Epstein's Palm Beach mansion before the FBI could conduct their search. So that raises questions about the integrity of the investigation and potential obstruction of justice. And adding to this controversy, evidence from Epstein's safe was reportedly missing following an FBI raid, further complicating the narrative and suggesting a possible cover-up. But by whom? Now, the implications of these disclosures are far-reaching, casting doubt on the effectiveness of law enforcement in handling high-profile cases linked to influential figures. Well, you know, if the cases are high-profile enough, you know that just by default, they're going to also involve high-ranking government officials, elected officials. Because that's just the way it is. And the most explosive detail to emerge is the naming of Hillary Clinton as one of the individuals whose communications were sought in Maxwell's phone and emails. Now, lawyers for Jeffrey were specifically looking for Maxwell's interactions with both Bill and Hillary. You know, kind of indicating a deeper level of involvement than previously known. Now, Bill Clinton's association with Epstein has been well documented, believe it or not, given their years of, well, they were friends for several years. But this is the first instance where Hillary has been directly named in the context of the Epstein scandal. The list of witnesses in the screenshot from the documents includes her name, which is bound to stir a lot of public interest and scrutiny, don't you think? Now, the timing of these revelations is also suspect because reports have emerged of a break-in at the house of Michael Citrick, an individual known as an Epstein fixer. See, supposedly thieves stole his computer servers just hours before this tranche of documents was released to the public, and that suggests a desperate attempt to keep certain information from coming to light. Do you think certain people could be killed over this information that's being sought? Certainly not beyond the realm of possibility. So this ongoing saga kind of underscores the need for transparency and accountability, which I doubt we're going to get, especially when it comes to the powerful and connected people. With each new piece of evidence, the public's trust in our justice system, which hasn't been all that high lately, and the ability to impartially investigate and prosecute wrongdoing by elite figures is kind of put to the test. I don't think the American people are expecting much from this, really. And as the case unfolds, all eyes are going to be on how these latest accusations against Hillary are going to be addressed and what further secrets may still be waiting to be uncovered. But what concerns me is how much stuff are we never going to be privy to? How much stuff is still being hidden and guarded? And probably a good deal of it guarded under the threat of death. Well, the third anniversary of J6 has come and gone. It was back on Saturday. And a huge portion of the American electorate continues to harbor some pretty deep-seated doubts about the legitimacy of the 2020 presidential election results. As a matter of fact, I would go so far as to say that the number of people who are now skeptical today over the 2020 election is much larger than it was even a year ago. Because the government, just by its sheer actions on a day-to-day basis, is proving to the rest of us that they have no regard for the American people. And this sentiment persists despite numerous court rulings that have dismissed claims of widespread election fraud. I think most American people, too, understand that the potential for more fraud coming up this coming November is ever-present. Now, the skepticism extends beyond the election's outcome, with a notable number of GOP voters suspecting that the FBI was complicit in the events of January 6th. But there are people now who traditionally vote a Democrat who are also carrying the same suspicions. Now, there's a poll that indicates that one-third of Republican voters are convinced that FBI operatives either organized or encouraged the attack on the Capitol. And this belief is even more pronounced among those who align closely with former President Trump, with 44% of his supporters endorsing the theory. And quite frankly, I'm surprised that those numbers are that low. Now, these beliefs have been fueled by a narrative of rigged election, consistently promulgated by Trump and his allies, of course. And despite the absence of evidence accepted by courts, and there's the key right there, accepted by courts, the idea that the election was stolen hasn't taken root within a significant segment of the population. And this narrative has been compounded by allegations of federal government weaponization, which have been a focal point for Trump's allies in Congress, and we have seen time and time again over the last couple of years, the actual demonstration of the weaponization, particularly the DOJ, against the American people. Again, I go back to that pro-lifer who woke up one morning and had his home raided by a SWAT team from the FBI. They showed up in multiple vehicles, tons of firepower, and right in front of his wife and kids was dragged off. Even when he had contacted the FBI and said, look, you want to talk to me? I'm more than willing to come in. No, it's the show business of it all. the show that the government insists on putting on, the government, the DOJ, this corrupt DOJ insists on putting on. Now, the impact of these convictions on the political landscape is pretty measurable. Because as Biden gears up for a potential rematch, assuming that he's going to make it that far, I'm not convinced he's going to make it through the year, focusing his campaign on the preservation of democracy. You know, MAGA is the greatest threat against democracy, to hear him tell it. Trump continues to rally his base with accusations targeting migration, inflation, and purported corruption. Actually, I'm going to take that word purported out of there. Corruption, we know it's there. And the divide between the two camps is pretty wide, with each side accusing the other of undermining democratic principles. Now, amidst this backdrop of public distrust, the legal woes facing Trump have done almost nothing to dampen the support of his base, hasn't dampened his enthusiasm. And despite facing four criminal indictments, Trump's managed to maintain a pretty fervent political following, many of whom view the charges as politically motivated attacks rather than legitimate legal challenges. I mean, come on, read some of these stories. And when you do see these stories with the big headlines, you only need to read the first two, three paragraphs and you have a basic idea of what the whole story is. The government is moving against you and me through the prosecution of Donald Trump. And they're going to keep trying it and trying it and trying it right up until the election day. It's sick. And with a significant portion of the electorate convinced of a stolen election and FBI malfeasance, you got the fabric of bipartisan cooperation and trust in the electoral processes at risk of further destruction. So as we move closer to the next presidential election, 11 months away, the challenge is going to be to bridge the chasm that formed between differing perceptions of reality. Without a shared foundation of trust in the electoral system and law enforcement agencies, the country may find, we as a country may find ourselves grappling with an increasingly polarized and potentially destabilized political environment. Am I talking civil war? How many times have I said? Every day I'm finding it harder and harder to believe that we are not going to end up in a civil war of a sort. Right now, it's mostly just ideological. Could it become more than that? I think it could. I mean, as the American people find it harder and harder to feed themselves, to pay their utility bills, the idea of buying a new car is only a dream these days for so many people. You know, as we see more and more evidence of that on a daily basis, it's pretty hard to believe that at some point things will not reach a boiling point. I hope I'm wrong. I really do. But getting back to this government and the public's distrust of it, you know, it's pretty important for leaders across the political spectrum. And we got a lot of good people in our government, but they have to address the root causes of this distrust, and they have to work toward restoring faith in the institutions that underpin American democracy. Only if we make concerted efforts to promote transparency, accountability, and dialogue can the nation hope to heal the divisions that threaten its democratic core. And part of that is we need to get to the bottom of the Ashley Babbitt case. There's still not nearly enough attention being paid to that. The killing of Ashley Babbitt. Because that officer, Michael Byrd, he's been rewarded for that by the government. And there is no reason why he should have shot her. He panicked. That was pure panic. And I know, I wasn't there, and it's probably hard not to panic when you have a mob breaking through a doorway in what is supposed to be the most hallowed building in our government, the Capitol building. And I would like to make allowances for Michael Byrd. But was it necessary for him to kill Ashley Babbitt? Zach Jewell, writing for the Daily Wire, which is a great publication, wrote that billionaires Elon Musk and Mark Cuban got into a social media spat this week. This was just last week, over the controversial race-based hiring practice adopted by numerous companies and institutions known as Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, or DEI, which, of course, is championed by the World Economic Forum also. The argument started Wednesday when Cuban, former owner of the Dallas Mavericks, took exception to Musk's definition of DEI after Musk said, quote, DEI is just another word for racism, adding that it discriminates on the basis of race, which is literally the definition of racism. He's not wrong there. Well, Cuban responded to Musk's comment in a pretty lengthy post on X, attempting to defend DEI and hiring practices. Now, in his post, Cuban argued that diversity, equity, and inclusion are all good goals for companies to pursue, writing, quote, having a workforce that's diverse and representative of your stakeholders is good for business. Equity is a core principle of business. Put your employees in a position to succeed. And then Cuban gave his defense for companies focusing on equity. Well, let me tell you a little more here about what Cuban wrote. He said, great companies create environments that reduce unnecessary stress of their employees. I'm not talking hitting quotas or getting the product out the door stress, which in turn increases productivity. This is what inclusion is all about. Making all employees, no matter who they are or how they see themselves, feel comfortable in their environment and able to do their jobs. So Musk replied to Cuban's post on Thursday, writing, cool. So when should we expect to see a short, white, Asian woman on the Mavs? Well, Musk's question caused Cuban to post yet another lengthy post attempting to explain what he meant by his defense of DEI. He said, since this seems to be the most common response, let me address it. DEI doesn't mean you don't hire on merit. Of course, you hire based on merit. Diversity means you expand the possible pool of candidates as widely as you can. Once you've identified the candidates, you hire the person you believe is the best. All right. And then he continued, what makes the whole what about the players comment ridiculous is that it presumes that all positions are hired based on some quantitative rather than subjective version of merit. They aren't. Even choosing the best basketball player is very much a guess, which is why the best players weren't always the first pick in the draft, and some go undrafted. The reality is that most positions hired in a company don't have a quantitative metric that you can use to hire someone. How do you pick the best barista, sales assistant, marketing or salesperson, etc.? More often than not, it's an educated guess. So the two billionaires then appear to agree on at least one aspect of looking at diversity in the hiring process. Musk said, I do think that if merit for a given job is roughly the same, then the tiebreaker should be diversity of all kinds. And then Cuban responded, he says, which is no different than what I've been saying. You expand the candidate pool and you're going to find great people that others ignore. Well, Daily Wire writes, large companies in the U.S. have integrated DEI policies into their hiring practices, causing some companies to be accused of race and sex discrimination. Technology company International Business Machines, you know, IBM, sponsored paid internship opportunities, one of which barred white and Asian applicants, and another that was only for women, with an exception for men who identify as women. Golly. Meanwhile, and this one is interesting. I wasn't aware of this. NASCAR offered a paid diversity internship that excluded white people from applying, which was first reported by the Daily Wire. And after the Daily Wire report, NASCAR removed the racial requirement for the internship. I'm not sure, but I think you call that progress. Anytime you consult the polls, Donald Trump is way out in front. Not a little bit out in front. He is way out in front. And a recent poll found that Trump still holds a dominant lead in the Iowa, what do you call it, the caucus? Anyhow, here's what Newsweek said. While Haley has made gains, she still appears to be well behind her former boss in Iowa. All of the latest polls show Trump more than 30 points ahead of his Republican rival, and even DeSantis is narrowly ahead of her in one of the most recent surveys. Polling conducted by Insider Advantage on December 18th and 19th showed the former South Carolina governor at 17%, whereas Trump was backed by 49% of respondents. DeSantis tied Haley in that poll with 17% as well. The survey included 850 likely Iowa voters with a margin of error of plus or minus 4.36 percentage points. How do they arrive at that number? Oh, well. Another survey carried out from December 14th to 18th by Beacon Research, Shaw and Company Research for Fox Business showed Trump at 52% and Haley at 16%. DeSantis remained narrowly ahead of Haley in that survey with 18% support. The poll included 804 likely Iowa voters with a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. So here's what it translates into. There is speculation now that Ron DeSantis, if he loses in this Iowa caucus, he's just going to drop out of the race and will support Trump. Think of the implications there. Ron DeSantis dropping out and supporting Trump, that's just going to evermore increase Trump's margin. To the Comedy Corner with Andrew Rose.
It's a lot of fun getting to do comedy. I love it. I love it. I haven't always been a comedian, obviously. I was a cook for 15 years. That's right? It's the one thing I'm good at other than being like mildly funny, which you just proved. And I love it. I love being a cook. I've learned a lot of things. Like, one, women, you're a lot like grills. I don't know if you know this. You're hot. I'm not really sure how to turn you on. And if you don't pay enough attention to them, they will burn your house down. So there's that. But the other thing that I learned, which I feel is more important, is if a Hispanic guy asks you to tell another Hispanic guy something in Spanish, don't. It will not end well for you. I learned so quickly that dude's name was not Señor Pendejo. Like, it was not a fun day. But I actually got to go to culinary school, and part of my culinary schooling, I got to go to Finland. And when I was in Finland, I had to take a language class. Now, the language class I had to take was called Intro to Finnish. Yeah, it's an oxymoron, right? We're walking into class like, are we learning to start to stop or stop to start? It doesn't make any sense. But I learned the language a little bit, mentioned that to this woman at a bar. She said, well, tell me something in Finnish. I said, not a problem. Moyoksi, kaksi, kolmenneli, viisi, kuusi, seitsemän, kahdeksan, yhdeksän, kymmenen, ravintolen. She said, what does that mean? I said, what that means is, girl, there's nothing I'd rather do than lay here and gaze into your eyes because they're as captivating as the Northern Lights. Smooth, right? And I know how to play the game. And she was like, really? And I was like, no. I go, what it really means is high, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, Northern Lights. It's an intro class. I'm not supposed to learn everything. Come on. But I graduated culinary school and started working at Whole Foods shortly thereafter. And anyone here shop at Whole Foods? Yeah, I'm not surprised. If you did, you couldn't afford tickets. I understand. That place is dumb expensive. It is so bad. Like, each grape is about $14.95. You go, I need a head of lettuce. They're like, you're going to have to refinance. Like, it is bad. And there's a lot of crazy people that shop there. I call them crazy. Y'all call them vegans. And are there any vegans here? Yeah?
You're saying.
No. I'm just making sure. You'll tend not to like the good things in life, so I'm shocked that you're here. joking. I'm joking. Listen, you live your life, be happy. It does not affect me, so I honestly do not care. But just letting you know, I'm never going to have as good a relationship with you as I ever will with bacon.
That's it. Make it a marvelous Monday. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on tomorrow's Bombastic Blogcast. Remember, no such thing as spare change, free lunch, or too much horsepower. And be sure to take some time today just to thank the good Lord that you're an American.
You mean that's it?
Tomorrow, G-Man.